Tonight, we're going to talk about the frontiers of science and the paranormal outside the gates of science with Damian Broderick, next on Coast to Coast AM. Damian Broderick, Australian science fiction and popular science writer, futurist, critical theorist, holds a PhD in literary studies, senior fellow in the School of Culture and Communication at the University of Melbourne, and the science fiction editor of the Australian popular science magazine Cosmos. He's our main guest tonight on Coast to Coast. Damian, welcome to the program.
Hi, George. Lovely to be here.
How did you get involved in sci-fi writing, first of all? I love that stuff.
Yeah, well, I was an imaginative but rather sickly kid, which seems to be the case with quite a few people who got into science fiction as writers. I spent my sixth birthday in hospital, and I lost most of the sight of one eye at some point. So I loved to read, but I couldn't play sport particularly well. So, you know, it lends itself to turning to imaginative worlds.
It does. You let your mind drift and wander, and it comes back with some surprising and sometimes startling results, Damian, doesn't it?
Well, that's true. Certainly when I was a kid, the sort of distractions that I'd like were reading comics, particularly the comics that were set in the future. There was one that I especially adored called Brick Bradford, which probably only older listeners will remember. Brick Bradford was an adventurer who had a thing called a time top, which was a kind of time machine that could travel anywhere throughout the universe and backwards and forwards through time. And I thought that was a wonderful idea, and I wished that I had one. And so many years later, when I got into writing science fiction, one of my main themes became time travel and the possibility of, living in different times. And also, of course, later on when I became interested in the paranormal, the possibility of precognition cropped up. So even when I was a small child, somehow these interests filtered in from not so much reality, but from the science fiction that was around me.
Damian, isn't it great as kids how we can let our imaginations wander and have fun doing that? But then a lot of us still stay somewhat kid-like, and we take that with us into our adult years. And I think that keeps us alive longer. I think that makes us young and spirited.
If we're lucky, we can do that. I mean, there's all too many people around who just become stodgy and dry and stick to what they consider to be the reality of the world. And, you know, they become unhinged in some strange way. And I think, you know, it's by keeping the, not the childish, but the childlike properties in our minds alive that we actually come in contact with the reality of the world.
I was riveted by the old movie, The Time Machine. I've always wanted a real one, a real time machine, but you know what? Do you think mankind will ever get to that point where we can do that, travel to and from, back and forth in time?
I think it's pretty unlikely that we'll have a machine that you can hop into and set the dial and pop out into the year
2036. Here we go.
Exactly. There certainly seems to be some physics that suggests that cosmological wormholes and so on might, or, you know, certain kinds of passages around black holes might allow a traveler to move backwards and forwards in time. But I think what is more interesting is the discovery, especially made in the last 50 years through paranormal research, that we can already do that sort of thing, that we can somehow, that our minds can latch on to aspects of the world in the future or the past, and we can get information from it. And I think that might turn out to be the more important reality.
You have gone on to the fringe with some of your topics, Damian, and you touched on the paranormal in some of your works. You've looked at ESP, you've looked at singularity and areas like that. Was that easy for you to kind of make that switch from being a popular science writer into these areas?
George, it's never really been a switch. I've always had this interest in, I suppose, what you could call blue sky, big risk ideas. At the same time, you know, while I was doing things like a PhD in literary studies and semiotics and all that kind of thing, I kept my mind open to the possibility of things that could be the case but might not be. But if they were real, the payoff is going to be absolutely incredible. And then from that position, I mean, I've had a long-term interest in the paranormal. I think that started when I was a kid, and it began by reading stories in science fiction magazines. And then when I was perhaps 12 or 13, I was sick home one time, and my mother brought me a copy of one of J.B. Ryan's books. I think it was called The Reach of the Mind. And I read this thing, and my mind boggled. I thought, you can't be serious. That this guy is a scientist, and he's telling me that these things are actually real. You know, until then, I'd assumed that they were just completely fantastic. So, you know, for several years in my early adolescence, as many people do, I did the usual attempts to forecast cards, you know, to predict the future or to read somebody else's mind and so on. And so, you know, that was an interest that persisted for quite a while. When I got to university, it's true, I started to drift away from that. I thought, well, you know, that's probably pretty unlikely. So for some years, I more or less ignored it. But then for some reason, a little later, I think one of the things that triggered me off was, again, it was an article in a science fiction magazine called Analog. And it was at the end of the 60s, as I recall. A couple of scientists said that they'd been able to demonstrate the transmission of a short word from one person to another using a peculiarly interesting method, or at least it caught my attention. And I thought, well, if that's true, you could also use it to get information from the future. And, you know, this could be a mind-boggling technology. So I spent what amounted to about 10 years pursuing that in one way or another, going back to old articles and, you know, reanalyzing the data that was there, trying out my own tests. And that culminated eventually in a study of what's called Tats Lotto in Australia. It's a lotto where you have to guess six numbers out of, I think it was 49 or 45 at that time.
Yeah, it's like Powerball in the United States. Correct. I think. Yeah,
that'd be it. And so rather than trying to do it myself, I thought, you know, I mean, I don't have any particular strong prowess at psi, as far as I can tell, but I thought this is a situation where there are millions of people highly motivated to guess the future. If I can just get the company that runs this lottery to give me access to a bunch of their data, I might be able to pull a genuine precognition out of it. So you can imagine what they said when I approached them, but I kept at it. And eventually, to my astonishment, they gave me, they actually did the computer programming for me. I mean, they pulled out 750 million guesses tabulated into a number of consecutive drawers. So I spent another couple of years going through that stuff. And I eventually wrote a book called The Lotto Effect, which was about that. And the unhappy story, really, the bottom line, is that it doesn't look as though there was any evidence for precognition in that vast number of guesses. But on the other hand, I did learn quite a lot of things about how you analyze these numbers and what influences people when they make their guesses.
Well, you know, and they get, I've always tried to use my intuitiveness whenever I play the lottery once in a blue moon to let the computer do it, Damien, rather than me. I try to influence the computer and say, all right, spit out these numbers. I never win.
Yeah, I don't know that the algorithms really allow that. This is the problem. Part of the difficulty that I had was that some of the data was contaminated, from my point of view, by the presence of computer-generated numbers. But on the other hand, they do tend to kind of wash out because, you know, all the numbers come up equally often. What I found, and this is something that really sometimes gets left out of looking at psi in the real world, is that people do have these profound prejudices towards some numbers and against from other numbers. So that if you look at, for example, suppose it was you had to pick six numbers out of 45, the obvious thing is that 30 or 31 of those numbers are going to be picked much more often than the others because
that's true.
Yeah, the dates.
Go ahead.
Well, it may not be the case that there's any particular preference for each of those numbers because people are born pretty much at random, I guess, unless the doctors have got in there with their knives and made sure that it doesn't happen when they're going to golf. But at any rate, even of those 31 numbers that are much preferred, it's quite obvious to anybody who's looked at preferences in humans that numbers like 7 and 13 and, 3 will come up either much more often or much more rarely in the choices that people make. And in fact, that's what I found. I found certain odd numbers came up much more regularly. Certain patterns will appear. If you're looking at the form to fill it in, it turns out that an awful lot of people do a cross, straight down the middle and straight across.
What is it about this ESPN lotteries, Damien, that allows people to tap into this field and to grab these numbers to do it? I mean, there's got to be something there that allows people to do this.
Well, to the extent that it does, I mean, my discovery essentially was that it doesn't work terribly well. The weeks when quite a lot of people won were the weeks in which greatly favored numbers came up by chance. And the weeks when hardly anybody won were the weeks when numbers that nobody likes came up. So, in a sense, I found if I'd had a lot of money, I could have invested again and again in all the unpreferred numbers. And when those came up, I probably would have won big. But really, you hear stories about people having, visions of the numbers or having a sentiment of a particular number coming up. But what you don't hear are all the other people who had the same thing, but they didn't win. It's difficult to make adjustments for that.
You called your work Outside the Gates of Science. And then, of course, the subtitle is Why Is It Time for the Paranormal to Come in from the Cold? Tell me, what does that mean?
Well, for the longest time, scientists have tended to reject the idea of the paranormal. And, for all the obvious reasons. I think the most apparent reason is that there has been a very long antagonistic relationship going back hundreds of years between religion and science, not necessarily religion as we know it today, but certainly in the Middle Ages.
And to the point where religion would kill you if you believed too much in science.
Yeah, just so. So, it's been a tremendous mental struggle, attitudinal struggle for scientists to detach themselves from that kind of approach. And eventually, meanwhile, there's also the fact that an awful lot of opinions about the world are based on nothing but superstition, erroneous judgments and so on, which were maintained by the authority figures, who were often religious. And so to break away from that, to break new ground, the prejudice developed against any kind of weirdness, any kind of spirit nature, whatever you want to call it. And at the same time, it also became like, science developed these unbelievably powerful techniques and new discoveries emerged by using them. But when you tried to use them to look at paranormal events, they didn't work as well. They weren't reliable. They were skittish. So, a lot of scientists just say, well, look, it's not science. It can't be done scientifically.
We can't prove it.
Well, we can't disprove it either, but why bother? It doesn't.
Yeah.
It's not affecting our machines. We've got these gigantic particle accelerators. You would think that if ESP was true or parapsychokinesis, that it would be messing with the numbers. But we don't see any evidence. Now it turns out, of course, that if you do the experiments right, you do see the effects. You don't see them all the time, but then psychology experiments don't see the same things all the time either because people are involved. You're no longer just talking about atoms and particles. You're talking about complicated minds. One of the things that I found really bizarre when I was researching this book are the number of experts who have popped up to say, I don't believe it. There's no evidence for it. Last night when you were talking to Russell Targ, you mentioned Michio Kaku saying exactly that.
He went right after him, yeah.
And of course these people then admit, no, we haven't looked at it because we think it's all nonsense. And that's an extraordinary attitude. That's exactly the opposite of science.
See, and I would have thought Michio Kaku, of any physicist, of any scientist, would have been the one to say, this is exciting. Because, I mean, he believes in, you know, time travel and everything else and aliens. But apparently with when it comes to remote viewing, that's a no-no for him.
Yeah. I think, I mean, it's a different kind of thing. I mean, his understanding of, you know, time reversal or, you know, gigantic leaps in intelligence in alien cultures and so on. I mean, all that follows pretty much from establishment science. I mean, certainly some people would regard it as dubious, but it seems to me to be pretty clearly a consequence of just accepting what we know about science. But the trouble still remains that the paranormal effects can't easily be explained in those terms. I mean, you get things like entanglement theory, and people talk about zero-point fields and so on, and that may possibly be the kind of explanation that will emerge, but there's also a lot of misuse of that, as far as I can see. So you can see why scientists would veer away from it.
Hey, what are you doing on my buddy Major Paul Smith remote viewer's website? What's that all about, huh?
He's got a wonderful rogues gallery, hasn't he?
He sure does.
I like the photograph of the guy up in the, whatever it is, the spy plane or something, wearing his, you know, technological helmet and kind of reading through the book by Paul. I couldn't manage anything quite as wonderful as that. I've been in touch with a lot of the people who have been involved in Stargate and, you know, the official investigations into Psi. And Paul Smith happens to live in Austin's, which is, I mean, I live in San Antonio these days, having moved here from Australia about 6 years ago.
Right.
And Paul lives in Austin, so, you know, we finally managed to catch up. A delightful guy, you know. He knows, of course, lots and lots about the nitty-gritty of this stuff, but he's also got a good sense of humor. And, yeah, we had a wonderful chat.
You're not a skeptic, right?
Depends where you're sitting. It's interesting to look at the... I mean, it's always interesting to do this kind of thing. Look at the comments that people leave on Amazon. The comments about outside the gates of science range from scientists who say, this is amazing, we've never really taken this stuff seriously before, but now we can see that it's worth looking into, through to the occasional person saying, this Broderick character is clearly a reductionist materialist. He doesn't understand anything about the spirit. You know, just ignore this stuff. I am, in fact, skeptical. I'm skeptical by nature, in the sense of show me. Give me the evidence. You know, I'm not going to believe it just because you tell me.
Well, there's nothing wrong with that. That's healthy, I think.
It's the only way.
As long as you're willing to accept it if they show you something.
Exactly. And not only that, but you have to go out and look for it. That's one of the things that a lot of people don't do. They're complacent. They sit back and they accept what they've been told. So, you know, being the kind of exploratory, investigative pest that I am, I do tend to go off and look into strange little areas. And, you know, when the evidence is there, I embrace it. When it's not, I tend to be fairly sarcastic about it.
Well, there's nothing wrong with that. Damien, we'll be back with you in just a moment. I notice on the cover of your work, you have... a bent spoon. Let's talk about Uri Geller in a moment. StreamLink, it's available to you when you go to coasttocoastam.com. What is StreamLink? Well, that allows you to download and podcast past programs and current shows as well. It's just a fun addition to Coast to Coast AM, and it's just pennies a day. StreamLink on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast, our guest tonight, Damien Broderick, author of Outside the Gates of Science. Damien, our dear friend Uri Geller, of course, comes on the program a lot, and notice that you have a picture of a bent spoon. I want your take on that.
Yeah,
been able to do that yourself, bend these little things?
I've never bent a spoon. I have tried numerous times because that's the only way to approach it. You've got to give it a shot. I have to say I was a little bit irritated that they used that on the cover. It seems to me to be a cliche that has... I don't know, it contains, to my mind, a sort of attitude of acceptance towards extreme possibilities that I didn't wish to promote exactly. But on the other hand, after viewing the idea of bending a spoon psychically with some dubiousness for a long time, I was talking to my pal Dean Radin, who you've had on the show recently.
Yeah.
And Dean was describing how he also had, was pretty dubious about the thing, picked up a spoon at one of those spoon bending parties and found the bowl of it just curling up in his fingers. I've seen the photograph and it's mind-boggling.
It is.
So you're not ruling it out, are you?
No, no, indeed. Well, I mean, not now because, well, for example, Stephen Schwartz, I'm not sure if you've had Stephen on.
He was Many times.
Yeah, okay. Stephen also, I asked him in a private email conversation whether he'd ever done this, and he said that his late wife and his son and he were sitting around one day, and they bent a spoon, you know. I mean, it just happened while they were looking at it. Now, I trust Stephen, I trust Dean. So, you know, what is going on here? I don't know. I can't do it. It seems very strange. But, you know, the thing about this book, and this is what I really want to convey, I guess, is that the first half of the book is an attempt to deal with these sorts of questions from, as it were, the skeptical point of view. I want to say, if you're a person who's not absolutely convinced of this already, here's the evidence. Here are the kinds of things that scientists have looked at, parapsychologists have looked at, and the sorts of things that they've come up with. And then in the second half of the book, I'm saying, let's assume that that's all accepted. Even if you don't believe it, even if you're still a skeptic, treat it as a kind of science fiction postulate. Mm-hmm. And let's see how we can go. How would we explain it? And I go through all the existing theories that I could find to explain how psi could come about and what its purpose is. And I in particular, I emphasize the idea of evolution, that evolution is what has shaped all our other senses. It's shaped our behavioral templates. It's shaped the very structure of our languages. So one would expect that since we're biological organisms, since our genes are handed down through survivors, that psi also, our access to psi, our capacity to use psi, must have an evolved function. And this is something that hasn't really been discussed at great length in the parapsychological literature, but I go into this quite a lot in the book, and I'm hoping that it will raise a new kind of discussion.
Well, let's talk about Uri Geller for a moment.
Sure.
He, you know, he's been on the program before, and, you know, the world knows who he is. You know, just recently commented a lot on the Michael Jackson death. But he is either a very, very good magician or he's extremely powerful. Now, when he's been on this program, Damian, he has done a mind thing on clocks that have not worked for years, okay? We've got millions of listeners to this program. So he asked them to get their clocks, hold it by the radio. And, man, I'm telling you, I got hundreds and hundreds of special emails and fast blasts from people who are saying, my clock's starting.
Yeah.
Some even started when the batteries were dead.
Yeah.
I mean, it was really weird. But, you know, he has had other magicians who claim that they can duplicate what he does via trickery. I don't know. I believe the guy.
Well, exactly. I mean, the problem is that, I mean, the example that you just gave is one of those things that's really shatteringly impressive if you've got one of those clocks. And it's very impressive even if you just hear the story. But it's pretty much what happens any time you pick a clock up and shake it one time in 100, it starts to work. I mean, I've actually done this. You know, I've fiddled around with watches and things that have been lying dormant. You know, suddenly they're going for a little while. So to me, that is, in fact, it's a performance. Whether it's a trick, whether it's psi, I can't say. I'd be pretty likely to think that it was a trick, actually, because I've seen the amazing Randy do exactly these sorts of things. You know, I've been in the audience.
I mean, he's a magician and good one.
He's a magician and he knows how to do it. It's spectacularly effective. I've seen him do the most astonishing things. I've also seen Uri Geller on stage, and I have to tell you, it wasn't nearly as impressive as Randy. So, but I mean, you know, if he's genuine, of course.
Of course it's going to be.
Impressive.
Yeah, exactly.
On the other hand, he does seem to, I mean, the one thing that we know about Psy is that it's evanescent, it's fugitive. You can't rely on it. You certainly can't get up every night on stage and do it. Now, admittedly, he sometimes blows it. He almost makes a sort of trick out of getting it wrong sometimes. But I don't think that's the way to look at Cy. You know, and there's, I just don't know. I feel very uncomfortable about all that stuff about flying saucers. And
now, tell me why.
Because it just looks delusional to me.
Interesting.
Andre, what was his name? His Baharich or something, his scientific advisor, seemed to kind of talk him into a lot of that stuff, I thought, in the 70s or the 80s, whenever it was. And then he drifted away from that. I think he began to realize that that was probably somewhat delusional, that he'd been suckered into it. I mean, I don't know the man, so for all I know, he might believe it still. But there seemed to be a lot of confabulation that was going on at the time when all that stuff about UFOs was coming out.
So you don't believe that any UFO stories are real?
No, I'm not saying that. I'm just saying that the particular story that was associated with Uri Geller struck me as pretty unlikely, partly because Baharich had actually been talking about all this stuff long before he met Uri Geller. There was a lot of a kind of complicated spiritualistic thing that he developed with some friends. And I think that Geller was probably tremendously pleased to be taken up by this guy and kind of got sucked into it.
He doesn't talk a lot about it anymore.
Yeah, exactly. No, I mean, that might be because he thinks it doesn't play very well anymore. But, I mean, there's certainly more people talking about UFO abductions now than there were then. So, you know, if he wanted to just make it up, he could be riding it all the way. So I think it's an indication that he probably doesn't really take it that seriously himself any longer.
Well, yeah. You never know.
You'd have to ask him. You'd have to pin him down, you know.
Are you believe in astrology?
Astrology is another one of those things that I think you can see why people believed it in the past when they thought that the Earth was flat and the sky, you know, the stars were 20 miles over their heads. But, you know, it's not like that. That's not the universe we inhabit. It was a good guess back then. It was a good working hypothesis, but it doesn't stand up. I know a lot of people say it does, but I think that's because they talk themselves into it. They convince themselves. Particularly, it's the people who have the personality characteristics that fit in with, for example, sun signs. Of course, they're going to be persuaded that it's true. And the 11 other out of 12 people whose signs don't fit them probably don't have much of an interest in astrology. So it becomes self-validating. So, you know, there's me being the skeptic again.
But it sounds like you've got an open mind.
And not only that, I mean, I have looked into it. I've read a number of books on it. I've investigated, you know. The thing that interests me, for example, is the Kerr-Callan effect, where the Mars effect, where you had a couple of French people looking into into this whole thing, finding that from their own analysis that most of the astrological proclamations of the past were in fact not true, but discovering these remarkable associations between certain sorts of positions of Mars and the Moon and certain characteristics of excellent military people, excellent sportsmen and so on. And one of my friends in Germany did a lot of work on this. And he's quite convinced that something like that is going on. And what's so strange about that is that his numbers look good, but they don't bear any resemblance to any other astrological system. So, you know, it's hard to know how to explain all of that. You know, all these astrologers around the world, you'd think they would have in fact got onto that.
It seems to work, though. I mean, every time we have astrologers on, they seem to be pretty right on.
Yeah, well, I mean, all I can say is that if the evidence is there, I'd like to see it. I know that there are, I can't think of the names now, but there are some important astrologers who moved away from it. A guy called Dean, was it? I'm not sure, but, you know, people who worked intensively in astrology who eventually came to the conclusion that it wasn't actually the case, that You know, but I mean, I don't want to argue about that because it's not my area. It's not something that I particularly studied.
Right.
And I've, you know, it's not of any particular concern to me to try and persuade people that their central beliefs aren't true. I'm much more interested in trying to persuade scientists that the basic psi phenomena are actually real, because they feel the same way about psi as I do about astrology, but I've got some evidence for them. I can show them this stuff, you know.
And be more specific when you say psi for scientists. What areas?
Well, the traditional thing, you know, where psi just being the word to mean extrasensory perception on the perceptual level of what we can discern about the world, not through our normal senses, and psychokinesis or anomalous perturbation, as they like to call it these days, meaning that we can create changes in the world by intending those changes to come about, but not actually doing anything with our hands or with machines. And I think, I mean, those are two quite separate sorts of things, in the sense that what we see with our eyes, the processes that are involved in seeing, the chemical processes, the neurology of taking in photons and processing them, is completely different from the process of picking up a stone and throwing it. So it might very well be that, you know, that ESP and psychokinesis are equally different from each other. But the fact is that it looks as though there might be some kind of unifying principle involved. Some people think it's entanglement. Some people think it's the spiritual nature of the person that is manifesting itself. I mean, they say, if your spirit can affect your own body, why shouldn't it affect everything else in the world? So, you know, that's what I mean by psi. Just all of that congeries of different paranormal events, apparently paranormal events, that can't be explained in the normal sensory muscular, you know, apparatus that scientists have examined for 200, 300, 400 years.
Parallel universes. Scientists are beginning to think that they could exist. I got to tell you, I personally find this absolutely stunning, because I can barely comprehend one universe, let alone many. But they're beginning to think that. Why?
Well, again, you know, so part of the problem here is that the ordinary language that we use isn't really competent to deal with the mathematics of physics. I mean, I know that string theory has generated a thing called the landscape, which basically falls out of the equations. It says any particular universe has a number of free-floating variables, and if we look at all those things having different values, we're driven to the conclusion that there must be 10 to the 500 numbers of different universes, most of them completely uninhabitable, unintelligible even, of which ours is just one. And that's absolute canonical string theory.
How will they ever prove this, though, Damien? How will they ever definitively show us that it sure is?
But I mean, but what interests me is that this stuff comes out of theory, and because it's so well-grounded, the theory itself comes out of everything else that's known about particle physics and so on. And so people will take this seriously, whereas with psi, there isn't yet a good solid theory. All there is the phenomena. So it's kind of backwards. You know, the people who believe in parallel universes or multiple universes or superposition or whatever don't have that much evidence for it, but they do have very powerful theories. And it's possible that one of the breakthrough moments that's going to occur with paranormal studies is the development of a really cracking good theory. Or, alternatively, if it turns out that, say, one of these string theories implies the existence of psi forces, and indeed some of the people that I know argue that indeed it does, you know, that if you follow through some of the consequences of advanced theory, you get things that look very much like reverse time and entanglement, and, you know, that might be the kind of approach that's going to be needed.
Well, it could be. It could very well be.
One of the things that I find interesting about this, to take a slightly different version, is the many worlds hypothesis that that at every choice moment, the universe splits into two or three or ten or whatever.
Like bubbles.
Yeah. Or like pathways. And so that, and by choice, it doesn't necessarily mean a human choice, an act of volition. It just means any time a particle is emitted, it could have been emitted at any random time, but, you know, every time it's emitted, there goes another universe, you know. Now, this, I mean, it's fabulously squandering of universes, but it does provide an interesting possible way of understanding precognition. If there's some way that we have a forecasting of getting information back from an array or an ensemble of possible futures, the most likely futures, then the choices that we deliberately make now might steer us into one future or another. Not absolutely definitively, but, you know, there'd be a tendency for that to happen. And one of the reasons that I think that this might be the case is that the Stargate remote viewers and others have found that if you get a group of remote viewers who try to predict a particular...
Much better.
So what happens is that they can't... Let's say they come together on a particular projection of what's going to occur, but then at a certain point, something happens, something changes, and suddenly they're all seeing a completely different future. They're all seeing the same different future, but, you know, it's not the one that they did see. And I suspect that that might mean that, you know, there's been a branch point that's happened. They might have had nothing to do with it, but, you know, so that we're now, we've gone from the most likely future then to a slightly less likely future that's coming up and is now the new most likely future, if you see what I mean.
Do you believe in life after death?
Well, again, I don't see strong evidence for it. I have friends who claim that they do see that evidence, but once again, it's an area that I haven't investigated very closely, so I'm not going to get pontifical about it and say that it can't possibly be true.
Where do you get the book, Outside the Gates of Science?
Well, I guess you go to Amazon and buy it
and get that discount, huh?
Probably, yeah. One of the things that happened with that book was that it came out exactly at the time that there was an enormous crash in a major distributor on the West Coast. You may remember about this Pacific Group West, it was called, which blew a whole lot of small print publishers out of the water and stockpiled their books, so that there are, in fact, quite a few copies of this book that never got distributed, unfortunately. I don't think it's an enormous conspiracy on the part of those who want to hush up my analysis.
Well, you never know, Damien. You never know. Well, the name of the book is Outside the Gates of Science. And it, just like you said, if you'd like to get into that, it's available on Amazon.com. Floating format tonight. Back with more in a moment on Coast to Coast AM.